radio show, and today we have the pleasure of interviewing Professor Stephen E. Brody. I'm sorry, how do you pronounce that?
Rhymes with howdy.
Okay. Browdy, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
And his book, The Gold Leaf Lady and Other Parapsychological Investigations, as well as his book, Immortal Remains, The Evidence for Life After Death. The professor is at, I believe, at the University of Maryland, is that correct?
Correct.
And is a expert in parapsychology investigations, as well as the idea of survival of consciousness after death. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Are you calling from Maryland today?
I am. I'm taking the opportunity to call you so I can defeat call waiting, which on Comcast is completely annoying.
Oh, yeah. That's correct. Yeah. Well, I am from Maryland originally. I went to undergrad at Johns Hopkins, and my family lives in Maryland. So, and in fact, they were educated at the University of Maryland, and my life was saved at the University of Maryland. I was an RH baby, and without the University of Maryland, I wouldn't be here. I was their first total body transfusion.
No kidding.
So, it was interesting because when I went back from my interview at medical school there. I met with a professor of medicine, and he basically said, I know you're not going to come here because I saw the other schools you got into, but I just wanted to meet you because I'm the doctor that saved your life.
How about that?
And so, therefore, that introduces the idea of synchronicity.
Yes, it does.
So anyway, I guess we can start with a little bit of your background and how you got interested in the investigations in the field that you have ended up in.
Well, it certainly wasn't what I started out intending to do. I began my graduate career in philosophy, doing work at the intersection of philosophy of logic, philosophy of language, philosophy of time, and I was writing a dissertation on temporal logic. And one day, it was a slow day in Northampton, Massachusetts, and a couple friends came over, and we'd seen the only movie in town, and we didn't know what to do. And they said, let's play this game called Table Up. What they meant was, let's have a seance. I'd never given any thought to anything like this. I had no knowledge of parapsychology or the serious research done in that area. And my friends really didn't know much about it either. They thought of this as a kind of parlor game that was fun when it worked, and they hadn't really thought about the implications of it. But for the next 3 hours, I watched my table rise in the air and spell out answers in response to the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, there was no way I could really fit that into my conceptual framework. And I was smart enough to know that I really couldn't discuss this with my mentors either. So, I literally put it out of mind. I went back to the business of finishing my dissertation. I got a job. I got tenure. And then with the academic freedom that I at least thought tenure would provide. I realized that if I was an honest scholar, I really needed to think about this extraordinary thing that had happened.
Okay.
I mean, there's no way I can describe what happened back in Massachusetts in a way that would answer all skeptical concerns, but I can tell you that this was my house, it was my table, it was broad daylight. My friends were not practical jokers. I don't even think they had a sense of humor. And if one of my friends got up, say, to go to the kitchen. The table continued to rise under our fingers, and we could be standing next to it, so we clearly weren't lifting it with our knees. So I didn't know what to do about this, but I knew I had to think about it. And so I started. I knew that some famous philosophers had taken parapsychology very seriously, so I read what they had to say, and then I decided there was something worth sinking my teeth into, and then I realized if I was going to do a responsible job of this, I needed to become a member of the community of scholars and scientists who were taking this material seriously, and that's what I've done, and now I guess I'm as much of an insider as it's possible to be in that community.
Yes, this it's interesting at how, and it's in all of the people that I know that are investigating this type of thing, how you do kind of put your career at a little bit of risk. In some people's eyes, when you decide to go down this path, but science wouldn't be anywhere without people taking risk. I mean, we would still be very much limited by the third dimensional constructs. If we had, scientists have not stepped out and pushed what I call pushing the limits of science further out. And the one thing I see is that we have to use all of science. Physics is very important. Chemistry is important. We have to use all of the realms of science to explain these phenomena. We had just interviewed Irvin Laszlo on his book, Science in the Akashic Field, and the importance of that work to understanding the phenomena that we're trying to explain with science is very important. So, therefore, on this show, we've interviewed at least 30 physicists and chemists and cell biologists and just everybody that has anything to say on the explanation of consciousness affecting matter.
Well, I commend you for what you're doing, and I agree that science needs to be somewhat less risk-averse than it has been up till now, but that seems to be the nature of the beast.
It does, it does. But hopefully with this new, I guess, we're almost in a renaissance of thought in science, where all of the various disciplines are pushing forward. I think when we find the connections, which I think are going to be multi-dimensional connections, and you can speak to that, in your book, and certainly some of these energies coming in to create these phenomena may be better understood with a multidimensional model. But one thing I wanted to ask about is the importance, and you emphasize this in your book, The Gold Leaf Lady, the importance of when the investigator is investigating to do so with an unbiased mindset. Because it appears that when there is hostility or preconceived notions or thought that is not neutral, that the experiments just simply don't work.
I don't know that it's so much a matter of being unbiased. I don't think any serious investigator can enter a situation completely unbiased, because they always have some idea about how things ought to be, how they expect it to look.
Uh-huh.
But the least they can do is to if you're dealing with a human subject, at least be respectful mm-hmm. of the human subject.
And, that's right.
And take them seriously. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that expectations and interests creep in very surprising ways. I can give you an interesting example from the history of physical mediumship, if you'd like.
Sure.
At the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries, in America and the UK and Europe, a lot of impressive physical mediums were doing their stuff. And one of them was a woman named Kathleen Gallagher, an Irish medium. And she was one of these mediums who produced, apparently, ectoplasm emerging from various of her orifices. And
mm-hmm.
She was investigated by a mechanical engineer named W.J. Crawford. And Crawford found that the ectoplasm coming, apparently, out of Miss Gallagher's vagina was bracing itself on the floor and then lifting up the seance table as if it was acting like a cantilever.
Hmm.
Now, that was something that interested him as an engineer, and he
right.
studied the properties of the ectoplasm very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the meantime, there were other ectoplasm-producing mediums on the continent in Europe, but they were being investigated not by engineers, but by biologists and physiologists, like Jaylee Richet and Schrenk Notzing and some others.
Mm-hmm.
And one woman in particular, a woman whose pseudonym was Eva C., she would have stuff, ectoplasm, emerging from various parts of her body, but it would assume not mechanical forms, but more biological forms. So there are close-at-hand observations of the stuff coming out of Eva C. and then forming, for example, a little hand with the fingers of a hand, which would wiggle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here was an opportunity missed. I mean, it seems to me that, see, at the time, nobody was taking seriously the possibility of experimenter influence, unconscious experimenter influence, which we
right.
know quite a lot about today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It would have been cool at the time for these investigators to switch mediums. It would have been interesting
to see if they changed.
Sure, it would have been interesting to see if Miss Gallagher produced more biologically oriented
right.
ectoplasm under the gaze of some of these mm-hmm. other guys and vice versa.
Well, that is a principle that's coming out of the study of consciousness, that that once we become an observer of something, we cannot help but influence it. And so
right.
I guess the scientists have to sit back and figure out how to get around that.
Well, but this has been known in behavioral sciences anyway. It's called the Rosenthal effect.
Right, right.
And there are all sorts of unconscious ways in which experimenter expectations can
mm-hmm.
influence the results where you think they wouldn't.
Well, would you like to take a minute to introduce our listeners to the Gold Leaf Lady? And I'm particularly fascinated by your explanation in here of the psychological, predetermination of a lot of the psychological conditions that pre-exist some of these physical manifestations. And I'd be curious to see if that was true of the ectoplasm as well.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the investigators from some of the older cases weren't thinking along those lines.
So they
so
didn't
the
record
of,
them. Yeah.
Yeah, the amount of depth psychological inquiry they were making
right.
was really very, very limited. We have to do it retrospectively.
Right.
But I think that's where the real action is. I mean, a lot
I
of
do
the times,
too.
We don't know what exactly is going on. In the case of the Gold Leaf Lady, it's, as I explain in the book, it's not clear how to classify the phenomenon, but
mm-hmm.
I think we can say something about why the phenomenon took the very peculiar form that it did.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of explaining it.
Should I explain this to you?
Yes, please. please.
What we've got is this woman in Florida whose body breaks out spontaneously in what looks like gold leaf, thin flakes of very clingy, staticky, metallic foil, sometimes piled on top of each other in layers. And although it's not really gold, it's made of brass. And people have observed this, and near at hand, I've observed it myself, it appears instantaneously. Although it, in a way it looks like it's coming out of her skin, I actually think it's appearing spontaneously on her skin. And
mm-hmm.
one reason I say that is that it also sometimes appears to occur on her clothing and on objects around her. So I don't think she's literally exuding it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think she'd have to have lethal amounts of copper and zinc in her system to actually exude this.
Right.
But in any case, this woman whose name is Katie, in some ways fits the standard profile that we know about in poltergeist cases. And in poltergeist cases, the standard or the received view is that these are person-centered phenomena. That is, they
mm-hmm.
seem to swirl around a particular individual called a poltergeist agent, somebody who, usually a teenager, who has some kind of serious emotional issues and no conventional way of resolving them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the standard view is that the poltergeist phenomena are like externalized expressions of this. It's as if the teenager can't get rid of these feelings himself or herself and goes, woof, and then it's like a kind of brute psychic flailing about. It's too bad you
right.
can't see the helpful gestures I'm making right now.
And
so suddenly when that happens, things burst into flame or fly across the room
right.
or what have you. Now, of course, it's not just teenagers that are in emotional turmoil, and
mm-hmm.
marriages are a fertile ground for that, too, as I can personally
right.
attest.
Yeah.
So I've often found that some of my best subjects of investigations are people who are in very troubled relationships, and that
mm-hmm.
seems to be the case with Katie. And she was experiencing, I mean, none of her, she's an all-round psychic for, in ways that I explain in the book. I mean, she
mm-hmm.
does quite a lot of stuff. But none of her psychic abilities appeared until she married her current and second husband.
Hmm.
And it's an abusive relationship in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a time when poltergeist-like things were happening to Katie. Objects were moving around, appearing and disappearing, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, a carving set appeared out of nowhere, apparently. And Katie's husband said to her, well, what good is it if it isn't money? And then 2 days later, Katie's body started to break out in what looks like gold leaf.
Right.
So my conjecture about this is that psychologically, or symbolically, it allows Katie to satisfy her husband's demand for something valuable, but she doesn't
mm-hmm.
really have to bear the responsibility of being the goose that laid the golden egg.
Right.
And I think it's also a way in which she gets to express her rage against her husband without having to take responsibility for it, because
mm-hmm.
It's a kind of fool's gold.
So this would fit in with the idea that thought, especially very intense thought, a very focused thought, and sometimes thought that is not necessarily conscious, thought and then combined with emotion, which to me drives things. Emotion is like the gasoline. If you really want to get something done quickly, get angry. One of my roommates here at the house was really a great psychokinetic when he was mad. And one time he got really mad at somebody who was talking on the phone, and a picture in my bathroom flew off the wall.
Hmm.
So, but I noticed that the PK phenomena with him were always when he was angry.
So it makes you wonder what happens when
he's a pilot, which is very interesting for a major airline.
but
anyway, so I was working with him. He was one of my students, and we would work to gain control of this, is the point.
Uh-huh.
So, but spiritually, you can kind of raise your energy to the level where these outbursts are not so frequent or intense.
But
I agree totally with your theory based on my own personal experience in this house.
It's what makes me wonder about people who have such an intense resistance to any discussion, serious discussion of psychokinesis, because it seems disproportionate to just what you'd like to think is a dispassionate scientific inquiry.
Right.
And
right.
I think I understand that, too. I think what's scary to people about any psychokinesis is that, if by thought alone I can move a pencil, let's say, a
mm-hmm.
millimeter, then it's a very small step conceptually from making a pencil move to making somebody drop dead by thought alone.
Well, yeah. And actually, you're on the show by virtue of Russell Targ recommending you. And Russell, during our interviews, that's how I learned about you. Russell, during our interviews, was telling us about the psychic research that was going on in Russia where they were remotely strangling people.
Yes.
So there is actually, at least according to Russell, scientific, I guess you could call it scientific investigation into whether or not you can strangle people at a distance. And evidently you can, according to what he learned about. I don't think anybody died, but they certainly were.
They were taking it seriously.
Well, the Russians were taking it seriously,
yeah,
and then that made our government take it seriously. And that's the story. Our listeners probably remember that Russell was in charge of $20 million worth of research for the U.S. government in this area of investigation. So I don't think that they would spend money just on a whim.
But I think what's scary to people about this is that, for all we know, it could be happening unconsciously. And there are very few people in the West or in industrialized cultures who are comfortable with the idea that if we have a nasty thought about someone, even just in passing, and then that person has an accident, that we might have played some role in that.
And that happens a lot of times in teenagers, because teenagers do have very, very intense, uncontrolled emotions because that's part of puberty.
Right.
And, there are plenty of stories about teenagers feeling that they have caused the death or accident of somebody through their rage, or whatever, their intense thoughts. And who knows? I mean, as you say in your book, things wax and wane. These abilities wax and wane throughout somebody's life. You talk about that later in the book, that, just like with great sports figures and musicians, there's a time that the phenomena, the psychic phenomena, is more intense.
So it seems.
And then
yes.
It wanes later on. That's why people, kind of start failing their tests later on. But that's just true of anything that we do in life. I mean, so you don't see many surgeons. I'm a plastic surgeon. You don't see many surgeons operating when they're 80.
Among the joys
probably for that reason.
So.
But anyway, I think that there is plenty of evidence in the consciousness realm that thought creates. Edgar Cayce, energy follows thought.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is the builder; the physical is the result. All of these more clairvoyant type information that we're getting is very much pointing to this. So I do think we need to watch our thoughts. I think that's a very important point coming out of the consciousness movement.
But do you think it's possible to clean up your act unconsciously?
Well, I think that what you can do, there are plenty of techniques out there for doing that, is to access the unconscious. You know, Jung was introduced the idea of the unconscious, and then several other generations of people have introduced the idea that you can access this through various methods, release the energy. I think that there are a number of releasing techniques so that you release this energy that is held in the subconscious or even further down in the unconscious. You know, the unconscious being not in any one particular body, but more archetypal in our society, in our humanity community, and release these energies before they draw negative things into our life or draw negative phenomena into our life, like setting things on fire or whatever the PK phenomena might be.
I hope you're right. I find that as I get older, I'm a little more cynical about the prospects for really purging our unconscious of all the nasty, vagrant thoughts that can flip through it.
Yeah, and there may be a time, and I don't know when. You know, some people say it's around 2012. You know, there may be a window of time coming up where we really see how quickly our thoughts manifest. And then once we see that consciously, then we might start to work more diligently toward releasing or letting go of our grudges, revenge thoughts, you know, all of these things, and actively work on forgiveness. Certainly a portion of the population is doing that now.
No question about that.
And a portion of the population is engaging in terrorist activities, and you know,
right.
it seems like we're going in two different directions.
Yes.
So, but I think that the scientific investigation of phenomena that falls outside of the norm is very important, because how else is science to advance if we don't look at the anomalies?
Not only that, but it's always arrogant, I think, to suppose that we've uncovered all or nearly all of life's mysteries. People have been saying that throughout intellectual history, and they've always been phenomenally wrong.
Right.
No reason to think we're graced right now at this particular point in history.
Yeah. Well, one of the I interviewed Deepak Chopra on my TV show a few years ago, and he said that the greatest fear that we have as humans is the fear of death. And this came out as I asked him a question of after he wrote the book How to Know God, what was his next book going to be? And it was, because what do you do after that? But anyway, he said that the fear of death was a great fear, and the one that he was going to address in his next book. And your book, Immortal Remains book, The Evidence for Life After Death, I mean, what can you say to our listeners who are pondering the question of does consciousness survive physical death? What can you say to that based on your investigation?
I would say, I wrote the book to figure out for myself whether there was absolutely compelling evidence.
Right.
Evidence of a kind that would appeal to somebody who's looking for something like scientific confirmation of survival of bodily death. And what the surprising result for me was that I learned how much more interesting living human beings are than I had previously appreciated. To me, the real problem is trying to figure out whether we've got evidence for survival of bodily death or evidence for something really remarkable that living human beings can do. And this could be just something in the abnormal realm, something like extraordinary memories or something similar to savantism or prodigies, or even more exotically, I suppose, psychic functioning among the living that just presents itself as if it's evidence of survival of bodily death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, if not impossible, almost impossible to decide between those options.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I mean, if a medium or a channel says, your Uncle Harry is speaking to me now, and he wants you to know that there's a hidden will in a secret compartment in his desk, and no living person knows normally about that, and then people investigate and they find out that, in fact, there is a hidden will in a hidden compartment. And there are cases like that, and they're very interesting. But the problem is, so long as what you get, for example, in a mediumistic reading can be verified. Mm-hmm. If it's there to be verified, it's there to be accessed by ESP.
Right.
So there's no way to be really sure whether what you've got is ESP on the part of the medium, for example, or evidence of survival. And the ESP in those cases is no more spectacular, I think, than what we get in the best cases of remote viewing.
Yeah, and the idea that there is something which Irvin Laszlo calls the Akashic Records, Casey referred to it, but Akasha being the library of everything that is, that medium could simply be accessing that library. And, because that's a bit of information. Now, Russell Targ, and you mentioned in your book, too, said that it's much more fruitful to go after a skill. And, had you heard Russell's story about the chess grandmaster who played for the medium?
Sure.
Now, that's a little bit. Now, how would you explain that? How would you explain that away with ESP?
It's, well, not so much with ESP. I mean, here's where the other kind of extraordinary human option comes in.
Mm-hmm.
See, what bothers me about a lot of the inquiries into the survival cases is that I don't think we understand very much really about abilities of the living. We don't understand what's going on in cases of savantism or prodigies.
Right.
You know, there are some, they used to be called idiot savants, but there are savants who have quite remarkable abilities. Not only are the abilities remarkable, they're also radically discontinuous with the person's other capacities. So you've got calculating savants who mm-hmm. can factor any number you give to them, but who can't add the change in their pocket.
Right, yeah.
There are musical savants who are spastic until they sit down and play the piano.
Right, exactly.
So until we have a better idea of what abilities are,
mm-hmm.
I think it's premature to say that living people can't suddenly manifest abilities which they've given no previous indication of.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. I think we're massively ignorant concerning quite a lot about the living. We're assuming that we know more than we do. And
uh-huh.
until we become more sophisticated in our grasp of what the living can do, I don't think we're really in a good position to evaluate some of these interesting cases. And they're very interesting.
Right. So you might suggest that the medium through which the chess games were played with the individual who had died previously and was a chess grand or second in the world chess grandmaster at the time, that she somehow developed these abilities just for this period of time, or
I know it sounds incredible.
Just asking.
Yeah, and please understand me. I'm not defending that. I'm just saying.
Oh, I know.
I think it's premature to say that it's impossible until we know more about what we're dealing with and what goes on in cases of savants or prodigies.
Well, one thing that interests me is this idea of the Akashic field, this idea of a field where things emerge from, they emerge as thoughts, and then they come into physical reality, gathering more matter around them. And actually, you could access anything at all from the Akashic. Casey used to be able to tell you where the cotton was grown on a sheet and where the wood, looking at a bed, where the bedpost, what forest that tree came out of. So the ability to access information, this is an informational field. So perhaps when we die, we just simply go back into this field and then we can come out of it as a more etheric being when needed. But then we can go back into it. I mean, that's something that I'm thinking. And that this physical world, the third dimensional world, is simply because of our organs of perception, it's defined as the physical world. But if we expanded our organs of perception, like many psychics and mediums and clairvoyants are able to do through practice, then we can see more of what there is to be seen.
You want me to be difficult about this?
Yeah, go ahead.
I know the idea of an Akashic record and Akashic field is mm-hmm. is pretty popular, but I think it's literally incoherent. It's,
mm-hmm.
It's not that I disagree that people can, and perhaps and apparently do, access all sorts of stuff. So I'm not questioning whether that kind of access is possible. I just doubt whether this explains anything. And the reason I don't think it explains anything is the same reason I think the idea of a memory trace, you know, an n-gram of memory, is an impossible object. Because the very idea of an Akashic record or a memory trace rests on the idea that some structure means what it does in virtue of its structure. That structure determines function. And I think that's literally false. That's not only literally false, it makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Nothing can function in one and only one way. So no matter how you structure something, it can't just mean one thing. Anything can represent or mean anything depending on how it's used.
Okay, well, back up, though. Back up to the thought, the meaning.
Right.
Where does that come from? I mean, does it just appear out of our physical brains? Or when many people search for a meaning, is it given to, like, three people at once, and then they all write books on it?
Well, I think the key to this, perhaps, is to get over the idea that meanings are things in some sort of concrete sense. I mean, we manage to communicate, more or less. I mean, I'm not sure how successfully people actually communicate. And that doesn't require that we absolutely know what we or others mean by what we say. It just means that we can. There's enough of a concordance so that we're not bumping up against each other all the time. And this connects with the way in which what we mean is very intimately tied to an entire form of life, to a background, and even to the type of organisms we are. It's why philosopher Wittgenstein said, if a lion could speak, we wouldn't understand him. Because the form of life is so different from ours. So, you know, people can be using the same words, and it can appear that they're agreeing. And for all practical purposes, it may seem that they're agreeing with one another and know what they're talking about until certain circumstances arise, and then you realize they really haven't been saying quite the same thing. So I think meanings are not things. They're not specific. They're not something that we can define in any kind of crisp or final way. And once you get over the idea that meanings are much looser knit sorts of things than a lot of people take them to be, then it becomes less tempting to suppose that there's some structure that captures it. I don't know if that's just too abstract for right now, but this is actually one of the big issues in the philosophy of mind.
Yeah, it is.
And it's at the basis of why I think most brain scientists haven't a clue what they're doing.
Right.
In my view, if you want me to be controversial, I would say that most of the cognitive sciences are really just bad philosophy dressed up in obscurantist engineering terminology.
Well, one thing I've realized from interviewing scientists from many, many different disciplines is that there has to be a single theory to explain all of the phenomena, all of the anomalies, and all of what we see in this dimension. And then I think you have to use physics to understand the multidimensional worlds. I mean, if you're going to go there, very few of us have the perceptual tools to actually view multidimensional worlds. So you have to do it through a physics model. So therefore, we've interviewed, you know, some of the founders of superstring theory, quantum theory, and even experts on dark matter, dark energy. You know, the whole thing has to be put together to really grasp at the model that you're going to set the theory of everything on. And that's what I'm doing. Now, how I got interested in this is simply very, very, very simple question. How do you explain spontaneous remission? And that's something that, you know, I'm a member of Noetic Science. They have a book on spontaneous remission. And, yeah, that's been scientifically documented. And
it's an extremely interesting phenomenon.
It seems like you have to understand certain things that, like, what sort of things do qualify for spontaneous remission, and why don't other things spontaneously remit? And I think the answer is the level at which the disease is created. If you put your hand in a fire and burn your hand, there is a physical cause at the physical level. And I think that that is not likely to spontaneously remit. It can heal faster. I mean, you can do healing methods and whatever and get energy off of it, and it can heal faster than if you had just done regular first aid care. But the diseases that spontaneously remit, according to the physicist Asmat Goswami and some other physicists I've talked to, are diseases that may have their causal, the cause of the disease at the higher levels. And so my goal has been to understand where does cancer come from? Now, certainly some cancer comes from the physical level. If you eat a carcinogen or put your hand in radiation, you're going to get cancer. But many of the spontaneous remissions of cancer that are documented seem to support the theory that the cause of that cancer may be coming from something outside the physical realm.
So what do you think is the relevance of studies of hypnosis, where good hypnotic subjects appear to exert really fine-grained control over various aspects of their physiology? Do you think that even in cases where you've stuck your hand into a fire and burned it, if you're a good hypnotic subject, you can...
Exactly. You wouldn't. That's true.
You would not?
Well, I think that there is evidence that you are less likely to be burnt under hypnotic control if you're being told that you won't. This goes back to the realm of thought. How much does thought influence the physical world? If somebody thinks all their life that they're going to get cancer, does that have an influence on them getting cancer? If somebody thinks that they can put their hand, in a hypnotic trance, their whole being is consumed with the thought that fire is not hot, how they do that, and then they put their hand in and they don't get burned. What is the effect of thought on physical matter?
Well, that's one of the key, that's related to the whole topic of psychokinesis.
It is.
Hypnotic healing. One reason I asked about this is that Clorinda Margolis at Thomas Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia mm-hmm. was getting tissue regeneration from severe burn patients under mm-hmm. hypnosis.
That's great. I mean, we have healing abilities within us that may be best accessed through the subconscious because our conscious minds tell us that burn's going to take 2 weeks to heal. You see what I mean? Consciously, if you have a second-degree burn, you've never really seen anybody with a second-degree burn not heal in 24 hours. It just usually doesn't happen. So we have expectations, and those conscious expectations are like concrete. I mean, they really are. They're like concrete. You're not moving what you know to be true. One of the things is we're going to all age and die. Now, how much is that ingrained in us?
And how some people age prematurely.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course.
And some people, you've heard this, I'm sure, because you study this, but there are documented cases of people thinking that they were bit by a snake, whereas really they weren't. They were they had two little pieces of a twig go in them, and then they die thinking that they've been poisoned.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty, that's a pretty good example, and that has been documented. That your thoughts can go up to and include killing you.
Another interesting manifestation, I would say, is in cases of multiple personality or dissociative identity disorder.
Right.
One of the books I wrote is on that topic, and I got to know quite a few multiples. And sometimes, as you probably know, when there's an identity switch, there are major physiological switches as well. It could be a change in eyeglass prescription. It could be a change in allergic reactions or resistance or non-resistance to drugs and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up the point. We have a NAIT practitioner in our office, Dr. Mike, who can, through these non-physical methods, remove allergies, including drug allergies and other allergies. And he's helped me over a number of pretty severe allergies. And without understanding what you just said, my mind would say, no, what he does can't possibly work, except that it's worked in me. But if you change it at the level of the non-physical, shift something at that level, then in the physical, an allergy to cats, for example, can disappear. That's one of the allergies that he has he's treated in May. And that's
very cool.
It is very cool because, you know, I went to an allergist with my cat allergy, which was life-threatening asthma, and it happened after my cat died and I had an inappropriate grief reaction, which is also a whole other story.
Sure.
And, you know, so these allergies don't come out of nothing. These allergies come as protective mechanisms so that you won't have that negative experience happen again.
I agree completely.
And so if it comes out of thought, then releasing techniques, which is what Dr. Mike does through acupoint meridian systems and using the, you know, using the energy anatomy of the body to release it out of specific areas, and then bam, the physical allergy disappears. So that's pretty good proof for what we were saying, that maybe thought and emotion, especially combined, thought and emotion could be the causative agent of a physical disease.
I agree, and it's one of the continuing mysteries that we've only begun to scratch the surface of. I don't think we know the limits to this.
We don't.
The conditions that are really and reliably conducive to it working for us or against us.
But I'll tell you one thing. What's one of the biggest financial crises in the U.S. right now, other than the war in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes.
It's healthcare.
Yeah.
I mean, you know it is. I mean, that's
sure.
The surveys say businesses, that's their number one concern, is the cost, the rising cost of healthcare. So if we continue to use very expensive physical methods to ineffectively treat diseases that whose origins are at a higher level, because I personally believe although you can treat the symptoms, until you treat that cause, you'll just simply, you know, waste resources.
Well, sure, and you're absolutely right. And so much medicine is involved in just addressing the symptoms rather than the underlying cause. And then if you just treat the symptoms, then you're going to create other problems which produce other symptoms, and then you treat those. It's why I respect Chinese medicine. In ancient China, people used to pay their doctors only when they were healthy.
Right.
So they didn't reward them for maintaining symptoms.
Yeah, that's true. And it is an economic problem, too. I mean, the doctor is now trained to spend 5 minutes with you, right? You know, 1 to 3 scripts that interact with other drugs you're on, and,
right.
And cause, according to one study, the fourth leading cause of death in the country is interactions of medicines that are correctly taken by patients. You know,
that's
pretty scary. So this whole model that we have in healthcare is ripe for a new paradigm explaining things that, and also just. Just, I think our quality of life isn't that good.
Yes.
Overall, I mean, look at the statistics of all sorts of statistics of U.S. health, from infant mortality to, you know, to diabetes and cancer rates and heart disease rates. We just simply are not a very healthy nation.
Is there some nation you think is doing an overall better job of this?
I think the statistics show that Europe is very good. Europe has, much of Europe has mechanism for catching people and not letting them drop out of healthcare completely, which the U.S. doesn't have yet.
Correct.
And so, and I think in general, Europe has a less stressed environment. They take more vacation days.
They do.
They have a, you know, in Spain, I don't know if you've been to Spain, but everything closes down and they take their naps and their siestas. And it's just a different pace.
I know I have a home in Europe and a wife from the former Yugoslavia, so...
There you go.
I know about how much more relaxed things are over there.
It is, and the
people
Japanese...
People take time to talk to one another. They sit at a cafe and just spend hours over a cup of coffee. They don't just take their laptops to Starbucks and frantically work on whatever they're working on and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, there's a cute thing going around the internet now about smoking and drinking and everything, and that the French smoke, or the French drink more than we do, and this other group smokes more than we do. So basically our high heart attack rate has to do with speaking English.
Right, I think that's it.
It eliminates everything else. But I really believe and that it is the expectations that more than anything, and I think Deepak Chopra, I was listening to some of his audio tapes, and I think he mentioned some experiments on this, that it actually became the expectations. I expect to live a long time because my family lives a long time. And is it really that the genes make me live a long time, or is it that because everybody in our family thinks they're going to live a long time, they live a long time? I mean, which is it? You know, do you blame it on the genes, or do you go beyond the genes and say, no, it's probably just the expectation?
Well, it's probably an interaction of the two. But
it probably is. Yeah, I think you're right.
I think either one would do it.
But together, they do it really well.
Absolutely. This is what philosophers call causal overdetermination. Any one of the things would do it by itself, but it may
be
that it's...
Yeah, but putting them together.
Yeah.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left. Is there anything you would like to address, any topics that we haven't gone into that you would like to share?
I would like people to pay more attention to some of the most striking evidence, what I consider to be the most important evidence in the history of parapsychology, and this is the evidence from physical mediumship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of people still believe that if there's going to be good evidence for psychic functioning, something that would satisfy somebody of a scientific turn of mind, that it's going to come from conventional laboratory experiments. And I think that that view is profoundly confused.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I disagree with it is that, in principle, you can't do a controlled experiment in parapsychology because if you're trying to study psychokinesis or ESP, you're, in principle, trying to study a phenomenon which, if it exists, can elude whatever controls you try to impose. I mean, you can't have a double-blind experiment for ESP. You
mm-hmm.
can only be blind to normal ways of acquiring information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in the case of a PK or psychokinesis experiment, there's no way to tell who's producing whatever results you're getting. I mean, you can't be sure that the official subject is producing the results. For all you know, it could be a bystander, the experimenter, somebody living in the trunk of an old Studebaker in Gary, Indiana. It could be anybody. So this is often called the source of psi problem. And
right.
What it means is the most you can do in a controlled experiment is to jot down whatever anomalies occur, but you can't learn anything about the phenomenon. The only way you can even hope to learn something is when you've got a superstar subject, somebody who can produce results over and over in different contexts with different experimenters.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it's not entirely clear who's doing what, but at least then you have some sort of prima facie reason for thinking that the subject is largely responsible for what's going on. And that's why the evidence from physical mediumship is so important, because during the mid-19th century, for about 80 years, there were some absolutely spectacular phenomena being produced by a select number of subjects. There were lots of frauds around, too, but some really good people. And they were producing large-scale physical phenomena under a variety of conditions, very tight conditions, with different experimenters at different times. And here, I think we begin to learn something about the psychological conditions conducive to the phenomena and maybe what the limits of the phenomena are. And so that's why, I mean, I wrote one whole book about that called The Limits of Influence. I write about it also in The Gold Leaf Lady.
Right.
And some of those experiments and some of those results are absolutely mind-boggling. And it's not true, as many people like to say, that these results were all obtained under poor conditions of observation with easily fallible testimony and in darkened seance rooms. I mean, that's a lie that's
true.
Promulgated by people who actually don't know what they're talking
about. The skeptics they do that. I mean, that's their modus operandi. Have you had any success with any of the subjects that you've interviewed, having them be able to tell you anything about what they're doing? I mean, you know, some of it, I know, is just occurring through them, like the Gold Leaf Lady. I think she considered that more of an embarrassment than an actual, you know, phenomena that was
worthy
of study.
She thought it was caused by Nostradamus. I mean, she had seen the TV show about Nostradamus and became fascinated. And a lot of the stuff that happens to her or through her, she attributes to Nostradamus.
To Nostradamus, yeah. But it would seem to me that one method of inquiry would be to, if the subject himself could gain some information about it, since it appears to be happening through them. Could they get any information? I mean, have you asked for it or?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Good.
But I get so many different stories. No, I don't think they have any more insight into that than do, say, great musicians have insight into how they're able to make music so well.
Okay. Well, that's,
I get all sorts of interesting stories, but the stories are just way too divergent, and sometimes it says more about the pomposity of the subject who thinks he or she has some great metaphysical understanding, and usually they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think it always pays to ask, because it's important to understand what they think is going on, but you don't need to expect it to be true.
Right, right. Well, you know, but if you investigate, we are coming, I believe anyway, we're coming to more of a consciousness renaissance in the next 20 years or so, so... You know, maybe some people are going to appear that do have some understanding of what's going on.
That would be great.
It really would be, because I think we need to, I think it's critical for the world that we pay more attention to the realm of thought, emotion, and what it creates. You know, the collective thought that, you know, we're going to enter World War III in a few years, coming out of certain religious fundamentalist groups, I think that's a very dangerous thought. I think that's something that could manifest, and scientists such as yourself, working at the level of the individual, it's important to formulate a science that incorporates consciousness and thought, so that we can quit doing what we shouldn't be doing, which, you know, is going to take us places we don't want to go.
Ideas can have a life of their own, even if it's not paranormal. I mean, just a kind of contagion of ideas.
Yeah, and ideas seem to, I mean, there is a study of certain phenomena that seem to think that ideas drop into the consciousness at a certain time and hit, you know, around the world. You know, maybe three or four people get the idea in the same time frame.
It seems
and,
that way, yeah.
And then they, you know, depending on their circumstances, if they have money, if they have connections, you know, one of them usually gets there first. Or if they have determination, like Thomas Edison said, you know, he has a cute quote about how many times he failed to make a light bulb.
Right.
But persistence, of course, is very, very important. But I do think that we might be coming up on some breakthroughs, and maybe that's what 2012 is about. You know, maybe that's if we can come through a consciousness renaissance and help some of our serious problems, our socioeconomic problems, our problems with not being responsible for the chemical and electromagnetic pollution that we've subjected the planet to, the healthcare crisis, and just the crisis of thinking that, you know, we don't have to be caretakers of the earth.
Well, I hope you're right, because that's one of those ideas I'd like to see become contagious.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the last 5 minutes. Is there any information, contact information? We can give the names of your books again so that people can order them.
The easiest way to find out about me is I have two websites. One is a university website with a URL that's impossible to remember. I don't know it myself. There's a whimsical website I have which has links to my more serious website. The whimsical one is jazzphilosopher.com.
Okay.
So that one's at least relatively easy to remember. Mm-hmm. And there's information about my books there. The two we've talked about briefly today were The Gold Leaf Lady and Immortal Remains, but there are some others too.
And in terms of the future, are you working currently on another book?
Not at the moment. I seem to be embroiled in other kinds of things. Some of which I'd rather not be, like I'm department chair again.
So you have all of that responsibility.
I do. I'm also now I'm editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which is a very interesting journal about scientific anomalies of all kinds, and I recommend people checking that out in the Society for Scientific Exploration.
Well, if you get a minute to look on the Internet under Google, take a look at Morgellons disease. Morgellons.
Okay.
I have found myself as one of the doctors who is studying this disease, and it very much relates to what we're talking to about today. And
good.
It in terms of a higher level of causation that is very possible, and I think you might find that interesting, and
I'm sure
especially as the editor of that journal. But anyway, I do appreciate you joining us. We have been talking with let's see if I can pronounce your name correctly. It's Professor. Give me a clue again. Brody.
It rhymes with Howdy.
Howdy, Brody.
Right.
Okay.
Even Brody.
Okay. I'm a little bit impaired in the phonetic department.
Oh, listen, my name's been pronounced in just about every way you can imagine.
I imagine. Well, on his book, The Gold Leaf Lady and Immortal Remains, The Evidence for Life After Death, and a serious student of parapsychology and the scientific exploration of anomalies that are very interesting, and hopefully taking us toward a theory of consciousness that can benefit the world. And I think that we all need to work toward that. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I have a few announcements that I'd like to do now. We have the Temple of Health radio show every Saturday. Next week, we will be interviewing Ron Garner on his book, Conscious Health. And the week after that, Dr. Daniel Benor, 7 Minutes to Natural Pain Relief. Dr. Benor is a holistic psychiatrist who is a student of spiritual medicine, and chronic pain being one of the major problems that we're facing, at least in medicine. The treatment of chronic pains with something other than chemicals is very good. You can access our newsletter for information about this, as well as the monthly Noetic Science meetings at www.plastikos.com or templeofhealth.ws. We have a integrative medical practice with family practice, GYN chiropractic, a number of different hypnotherapy, psychotherapy, and then all the plastic surgery and skin care. Everything else that we offer is in the newsletter. And we want to thank you very much for joining us. This has been Temple of Health Radio Show. We'll see you next week.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong, it was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastikos were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastikos and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastikos did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastikos is a bargain.
Plastikos, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677. Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
Please join us every Saturday morning for Temple of Health Radio Show, brought to you by Plastikos and Millennium Healthcare. Our holistic medical practices in Atlanta are committed to community education. Our shows bring you national authors on topics of health alternatives, new scientific breakthroughs, and spiritual medicine.